We present the unbelievable truth, the panel game built on truth and lies. In the chair, please welcome David Mitchell.
Hello and welcome to the unbelievable truth, the panel show about incredible truths and barely credible lies. I'm David Mitchell. Please welcome Lucy Porter, Tony Hawks, Holly Walsh and Alan Davis. The rules are as follows. Each panellist will present a short lecture that should be entirely false, save for five hidden truths which their opponent should try to identify. Points are scored by truths that go unnoticed, while other panellists can win points if they spot a truth or lose points if they mistake a lie for a truth. First up is Holly Walsh. Holly is one of the writers of the hit sitcom Motherland, all about the difficulties of modern parenting. It's on at 9 in the evening, just after its target audience have opened their second bottle of wine. Holly, your subject is Essex, a county in southeast England located between London and the North Sea. Off you go, Holly. Fingers on buzzers, the rest of you.
People from Essex have more PhDs than any other county in England, though these should clear up with a course of antibiotics.
Lucy.
I mean, why not? The University of Essex is a fine institution.
It's not true, but there seem to be no statistics on how many PhDs people from a county then get.
Yeah. I've got a friend who's doing a PhD at the University of Essex.
There you go. Yeah. My point is proven.
So
you
can at least measure. From
well, it's
one.
At least, I'm going to write like one.
But well, he might fail.
Yeah,
she.
So basically,
she won't
fail. What we know is that one person in Essex definitely doesn't currently have a PhD.
The Crown Princess of Essex, Gemma Collins, has garnered not one, not two, but actually, yes, two doctorates, one in neuroscience and one in advanced hair bleaching. Though the neuroscience one came free with a copy of Heat. And an Essex man called Pat Chaplin was the first person to get a PhD in darts. He was aiming for a double first in history, but slipped on the hockey.
Lucy.
PhD in darts, go on.
Correct!
Yay!
Yes, Patrick Chaplin from Malden is known as Dr. Darts after he gained a PhD in the history of darts in 2006.
The singer Paul Potts hails from Southend and after winning The X Factor, went on to a successful career with Opera Southeast before retiring to run Cambodia in the 1970s. At one point, the county housed the world's largest collection of human brains until a gardener accidentally mulched them into compost, hence Brain Tree. Other quaintly named Essex places include West Slappersby, Arslick, Fingering Hoe, Little Gigolo on the marshes, and the tiny village of Bumming.
Tony.
One of those is going to be true.
Yes, maybe.
And I think it's the only plausible one, really, so it won't be it, but I'm going to say it anyway. West Slackerby. I had tea in West Slackerby once.
Slappersby.
Oh, right.
If you misheard it as Slackersby, you can withdraw your buzz.
Can I withdraw it? I
don't. You wish to withdraw the buzz?
No, I would no. A buzz is a buzz.
I'm sorry, Holly, I didn't realise you were in charge.
I'm not in charge.
My feeling is that if Tony sincerely thought it was West Slackersby, that is more plausible than Slappersby.
Sure.
Thank you.
Oh. Lucy.
Well, I'll take it.
What?
West Slappersby.
No, that's not true.
No. I'm not sure that I'm ready to give up on that list. I think the tiny village of Bumming sounds a delightful place to spend an afternoon.
The second buzz.
There it is.
No such place.
And Saffron Walden used to just be called Walden, but it got really into trading saffron, so it rebranded. See, those guys are always thinking.
Alan.
I'm prepared to believe that.
The rebranding of
Saffron Walden.
That's absolutely correct. Once just known as Walden. It's got its name of Saffron Walden in 1514 after the saffron crocus was grown extensively in the area, making this Essex market town the centre of the English saffron trade.
Another cliché to destroy is the idea Essex folk are all self-absorbed meatheads. In fact, it's a very giving county. Towie alone has added £1.4 billion to the UK economy, mainly because whenever it's on television, half the nation kick their TVs in and have to buy a new one.
Lucy.
Towie has added £1.4 billion to the UK economy. I don't know how you'd measure that, but that you can measure fake tan sales, teeth whitening, vajazzles.
That is exactly what someone has done.
Yes.
Yes, that's absolutely right. Since it first aired in 2010, it's estimated that Towie, or The Only Way is Essex, has contributed over £1.4 billion to the UK economy.
And lastly, Essex people aren't at all promiscuous. In fact, Essex has the lowest rate of premarital sex in the country. At least, it did when I went there on a girls' holiday in my 20s.
Thank you, Holly. And at the end of that round, Holly, you've managed to smuggle two truths past the rest of the panel, which are that Essex housed the world's largest collection of human brains, totalling 8,000 specimens, in a bomb shelter beneath a psychiatric hospital in Wickford, Essex. They were collected by a consultant pathologist at the hospital who, after the post-mortem, kept the brains of the patients who most interested him instead of disposing of them. The brain collection is now housed at St Bernard's Hospital in Southall and has become a vital research tool worldwide. So, well done, that creepy brain collector. And the second truth is the place name that was correct, which is Fingringhoe. It's a village near Colchester. Other unusual place names in Essex include Steeple Bumstead, near Braintree, Dancing Dick's Lane, and the village of Ugly, near Stansted Airport, which was once home to the Ugly Women's Institute. before they decided to change it to the Nasty Women's Institute. No, the Women's Institute of Ugly. And that means, Holly, you've scored 2 points. Southend boasts the longest pleasure pier in the world. The pleasure element comes from the fact that the further you walk along it, the further away from Essex you are. OK, we turn now to Tony Hawks, a successful actor, comedian, writer, singer and songwriter. We're all people we tried to get on the show this week, but instead, here's Tony Hawks. Tony, your subject is the candle, a stick or block of hard wax or tallow containing a central wick which is lit to produce light as it burns. Off you go, Tony.
In Victorian times, candles were used for measuring the length of time one was allowed to do almost anything. Theatre patrons were issued with 1-inch candles prior to entering toilet cubicles for the purpose of doing a number two. Nighttime jewels would have to be completed within a 12-minute candle burning time, and in brothels, candles burned for 7 minutes. Sometimes these were gently inserted into the customers' bodies where the sun don't shine. And it's believed this is where the expression burning the candle at both ends may derive. Perhaps due to their high animal fat content, Marie Antoinette once declared of the French peasantry, "Let them eat candles." "Let them eat candles" went on to become a successful retailer of edible candles for birthday cakes.
Lucy.
There is an edible candle company called Let Them Eat Candles.
There is indeed. Mm. Yeah.
At his parties, Emperor Nero would have a huge birthday cake borne into his dining chamber by slaves, and he used Christians as candles. He only stopped when he became too old to blow them all out at once. The expression, "you can't hold a candle to it," was first used by Alfred Nobel on demonstrating his new invention, nitroglycerine. They were also his famous last words. Most things are better done by candlelight. For example, picking potatoes, attracting spiders, harvesting rhubarb.
Holly.
Harvesting rhubarb.
Correct. Oh. Yeah.
Are you a gardener, Holly?
No.
Oh. Felt like you really knew that one.
I did know that one because you do cover them over.
I've been aware that you sort of put a tube around them to make them grow up towards the light in order to maximise the amount of the
horrible... Don't eat the leaves. Don't eat the leaves.
Of the rhubarb. I tell you what,
we were told all the time, we had it in our garden.
I would say don't eat the rhubarb at all because it tastes horrible.
No.
The one thing I will say for rhubarb is that it's nicer than gooseberries.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean,
oh, that's
like saying Stalin was nicer than Hitler.
No. You said rhubarb is Hitler.
Yeah.
Well, all this is, David, is you're obsessed with Hitler. Never a show goes by without Hitler coming into it.
Yeah,
that's true.
I am obsessed with Hitler. But also, if you were listening, I said gooseberries were Hitler and rhubarb was Stalin. So the thing that was true is that harvesting rhubarb by candlelight is commonly practiced in Yorkshire's Rhubarb Triangle, which sounds like a horrible place. Yorkshire's Rhubarb Triangle.
It's one of Barry Manilow's less successful songs.
In order to ensure the sweetness of the rhubarb. Entirely unsuccessfully, in my experience.
In America, 85% of women make a wish when they blow out the candles on their birthday cake, while only 5% of men do. 96% of all the candles in America are bought by women.
Lucy.
Either women buy 95% of candles or women wish and men don't.
You can't have two. I was going to have one of those.
OK, then I'll go for the wishes then.
85%
of women make a wish and only 2% of men do.
That's not true.
little fast finger, Lucy.
There were, a US survey of 2010 did reveal that 75% of women make a birthday wish when they blow out the candles, while only 17% of men do.
Women are more hopeful, and men are just thinking, I wish he hadn't made me blow these bloody candles. Yeah.
But, I mean, the most famous wish requester of all is Aladdin, and he was a bloke.
I think it would all change if there was a genie. I'd chance a wish if there was a genie.
The truth is, if there's a genie, it ceases to be a wish and becomes an order, doesn't it? It's just like in a restaurant, I'm happy to make some wishes. I wish to have a prawn cocktail and then a steak, for example. Oh, my wish has come true.
Have you not?
There's someone who can make your wish come true. It's not a wish. It's just like, OK, well, I want, you know, world domination, please. Here you go, Mr. Hitler. I'm not upset.
I wish he'd have rhubarb every day.
In Moldova, candles outsell milk.
Alan.
I'm going to say that's true because I've read your rather excellent book about Moldova, and I believe that you know things about Moldova that you might slip in.
Yeah.
Ah. Well, one
true.
Part of that was true. The excellent book.
I think it's unfair to have a go at David for bringing up Hitler when you shoehorn Moldova into any conversation.
Yeah.
Well, not everyone. I mean, did I mention it backstage?
I didn't mention Hitler backstage.
Yeah, but you were chomping at the bit.
Yeah. You kept combing your hair in the mirror.
Well, in Moldova, I'm afraid candles do not outsell milk.
Oh, shame.
Well, that's the end of Tony's lecture. At the end of that round, Tony, you've managed to smuggle three truths past the rest of the panel, which are that brothels had candles that burned for 7 minutes. Oh. Brothel candles were used during Victorian times. They were about the length and size of a matchstick. The customer would pay the fee, light the candle, and when the candle burnt out, the session was over. Some women would trim the candles down to speed things up even further. The second truth is that the Emperor Nero used Christians as candles.
Oh, my God.
He's worse
every time I hear about this bloke. Yeah.
According to Tacitus, Emperor Nero would burn Christians in his gardens, quote, to serve as a nightly illumination when daylight had expired.
Why do you think they've gone with the name Cafe Nero, knowing how much we know about it? Yeah.
No, it shows you. After giving a couple of thousand years, these people become desanitised, don't they? And the third truth is that 96% of all the candles in America are bought by women.
No.
This is according to American candle manufacturers. Anyway, Tony, that means you've scored 3 points. Vincent van Gogh painted his night scenes by fixing candles to his straw hat. Examples include the evocative work Starry Night over the River Rhone and the lesser-known Man with Hat on Fire. Next up is Lucy Porter. Lucy, your subject is advertising, the activity or profession of producing advertisements for commercial products or services. Off you go, Lucy.
When it comes to ads making grandiose claims, breakfast cereal companies are by far the most guilty. When first launched in 1935, Kellogg's All Brand claimed to fight the 14 signs of moral turpitude. While Grape Nuts originally boasted of their ability to prevent appendicitis and cure malaria, and in the USA, Honey Nut Cheerios are still marketed on their ability to defeat both ghosts and socialism.
Tony.
All Brand.
All Brand fight the 14 signs of moral turpitude.
I don't like the way you're saying that.
It's David. Not true, I'm sorry.
Oh, it would have been a great slogan.
I like the turn of phrase, yeah. The 14 signs of moral turpitude. Yeah. Alan.
What about the grape nuts and the medical
appendicitis
conditions?
And malaria. I was going
to say grape nuts.
You're absolutely right. Oh. Grape nuts is right. Yeah. Early advertisements for Grape Nuts claimed that the cereal could prevent appendicitis, tighten loose teeth, and cure malaria, rickets, rheumatism, heart disease, and, quote, brain problems.
You know when people have gallstones and then they break them down and they can get out of you? I always think of them as Grape Nuts.
There's like a grape nut in the gallbladder.
Well, like, I think of a disintegrated gallstone, or whatever those stones are called, kidney stones.
Well, you get both, the two sorts of stones. You can get gallstones in your gallbladder and kidney stones in your... I can't remember where.
It's the only way for a gallstone to come out for your penis.
Well, no, that's the kidney stone, that is. I don't know. I don't know how you treat... I think I'm going to have to go on the record. If you've got gallstones, you need to ask someone else.
You do have the air of a GP about you.
Thanks. And like a GP, I'm not much of an expert in anything. But I'll have a look at you via Zoom and say I'm sure that'll be okay.
Appropriately enough, the first advert on Channel 4 was for Four Seasons Hotels, and the first product advertised on Channel 5 was Chanel No. 5, allowing Chanel to perfectly target their chic and sophisticated audience of people who like programmes about trains and strippers. Bob Dylan said that if he ever sold out and did a commercial, it would be for ladies' undergarments. And true to his word, he appeared in a Victoria's Secret commercial in 2004. The red peephole bra didn't particularly suit him, but fans only started booing and shouting Judas at the end of the commercial when he turned on an electric blanket. Neil Diamond wrote the jingle for Cadbury's Flake. My father, Cole Porter, wrote the immortal couplet, "You do the shake and back and put the freshness back." While the tune and lyrics for You Can't Get Better Than a Quick Fit Fitter were created by a grateful Bjork after the mechanics at the Telford branch did a really good job of flushing her exhaust pipe and realigning her big end.
Right, I've not had a very good run on things recently, but I'm very confident, very, very confident that Neil Diamond did the Flake commercial.
No, he didn't. What one of you think? Only the crumbliest, flakiest chocolate.
Well, whatever, doesn't matter. It's gone now. Move on.
Sweet, lovely flake.
It says in the ad that it tastes like chocolate never tasted before, but it turns out that it tastes exactly like chocolate has always tasted.
Yeah.
Which is plus, I think.
When McDonald's did It's Nothing Like a McDonald's, you know, I always thought Burger King was quite... quite similar.
Whereas chocolate just gave ladies orgasms.
Yeah, exactly. But also caused floods, I remember.
Yes. Well, I mean, orgasms do cause floods.
That was what was going on in the Somerset Levels.
Language is a constant worry for advertisers. The name of the Vauxhall Astra translates literally into Ukrainian as tramp's wheelbarrow. And in Mexico, the slogan, "It takes a tough man to make a tender chicken," became the terrifying, "It takes a hard man to make a chicken aroused." The longest advert ever shown on British television, lasting 7 minutes, was for British Rail. It was only meant to be 2 minutes long, but was delayed by scheduled engineering works.
Thank you, Lucy.
Thank you.
And at the end of that round, Lucy, you've managed to smuggle four truths. And they are that the first product advertised on Channel 5 was Chanel No. 5. The second truth is that Bob Dylan said that if he ever sold out and did a commercial, it would be for ladies' undergarments. And true to his word, he appeared in a Victoria's Secret commercial in 2004. The third truth is that the longest ever advert on British television, 7 minutes, was for British Rail. It was shown on Christmas Day in 1977. Very glad to have missed that. That's nearly as long as the Queen's speech. And the BFI have classified it as a film on their website. Imagine if it had won the Oscars that year. And the fourth truth is that in Mexico, it takes a tough man to make a tender chicken became it takes a hard man to make a chicken aroused. It's an advert for US chicken company Purdue Farms. And it appeared in Spanish on billboards all over Mexico. A photo of Frank Perdue with one of his birds appeared with the caption, "It takes a hard man to make a chicken aroused." And that means, Lucy, you've scored 4 points. In the early 2000s, a T-shirt maker in Miami printed shirts for the Spanish market promoting a visit of the Pope. But instead of "I saw the Pope, El Papa," the shirts read "I saw the potato, La Papa." Fortunately, he was able to sell the entire consignment to Manchester United, who'd just signed Wayne Rooney. It's now the turn of Alan Davis. Your subject, Alan, is water, one of the most plentiful and essential compounds on Earth. Off you go, Alan.
Bottled water costs 10,000 times as much to produce as tap water. However, smug tap water purists should note that every day Thames Water removes over a tonne of pubic hair at its water treatment plant.
Tony.
I've heard this, that they do remove all this pubic hair.
It was a bit of a sort of internet meme, but it's not true. Yeah. Thames Water have denied it vociferously.
Not true about the pubes!
Yeah. I wasn't ringing about that, actually.
How would you tell what was a pubic hair? That's someone's job, going, pube, not pube.
Actually, they'd say, yes, it may be a ton every day, but a lot of it's nostril hair.
Kim Basinger likes to wash her hair in Evian water. She also pours lime juice and WD-40 into her bath water. I must admit, I do too, but I find it's best to put the lime and WD-40 into the bathwater after I've got out. One of nature's wonders, a water boatman has the largest penis in relation to body size ever recorded. His name is Colin Pringle, and he works on Lake Windermere.
Tony.
I think water boatmen have enormous penises in comparison to their general size. Well, I've seen it as they swim, you know. They can't go in a straight line because of it.
They don't. What you might be remembering from a previous episode is the loudest noise in nature in comparison to the size of the organism creating it is made by the water boatman's penis.
How does a penis make noise?
I think it's different from the human penis.
I think it's got speakers.
It must have.
Although you'd think they have the mouth for it, frogs don't drink water, but they do have to use a lot of moisturiser to avoid drying out and turning into toads or biscuits.
Tony.
Frogs don't drink water.
They don't.
Yes! Well done.
They don't drink water, they absorb it through their skin via a patch located on their bellies.
The Jesus Christ frog is named after its ability to walk on water. The Titanic water spider is named after its inability to do so. Chinese scientists have reported that a giraffe's DNA is almost identical to that of a sponge. This is why a giraffe can go without water longer than a camel.
Holly.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. Sponges and giraffes, pretty similar.
The DNA identicalness, sponges and giraffes, not true. Tony.
A giraffe can go without water for longer than a camel.
Correct.
Oh!
Giraffes can go up to 21 days without water, while camels can survive only 15 days.
When the Spanish conquistador Pedro Alvarez Cabral claimed Bolivia for the Spanish throne, the Bolivian chief Quilombo offered him a ritual goblet of clear water. But Cabral was startled to see the Bolivian stir in a handful of llama droppings. The interpreter explained that in Bolivia, llama droppings are used to purify water, so Cabral doubted him one. Incidentally, it was Cabral who coined the phrase Montezuma's revenge. In the fiercely hot summer of 1813, the Royal Navy was concerned about the amount of water sailors were pouring over themselves to cool down after vigorous dancing on the poop deck. For this reason, on August the 9th, the Navy brought in a hornpipe ban. The hornpipe ban's quite a good joke, actually.
That's very nice.
They'll be laughing on the way home. Holly.
Is there something in that that the Navy got worried about the amount of water that naval men were using to shower themselves with?
No. No. I suspect they wouldn't allow them to shower themselves with the drinking water. Not
what
unless...
were they supposed to shower with?
Well, maybe they get some water out of the, I don't know, sea.
Listen, I don't like your attitude. That's just rude.
Thank you, Alan. And at the end of that round, Alan, you've managed to smuggle three truths past the rest of the panel, which are that bottled water costs 10,000 times as much to produce as tap water. This is according to a 2006 study by the Earth Policy Institute. The second truth is that Kim Basinger likes to wash her hair in Evian water. Experts say washing your hair with bottled water can improve its health as you avoid introducing the environmental pollutants found in hard tap water. As well as, of course, the tons and tons of pubes. And the third truth is that in Bolivia, llama droppings are used to purify water. And that means, Alan, you've scored 3 points. There's a golf course in Australia with a water hazard that contains several sharks. You're allowed to try and fish your ball out, but the official advice is to accept a 2-shot penalty and start afresh. That advice comes from the club professional, Lefty. Which brings us to the final scores. In fourth place, with -2 points, we have Holly Walsh. In third place, with -1 point, it's Tony Hawkes. In second place with 2 points, it's Lucy Porter. And in first place with an unassailable 3 points is this week's winner, Alan Davies. That's about it for this week. Goodbye.
The Unbelievable Truth was devised by John Naismith and Graham Garden and featured David Mitchell in the chair with panellists Tony Hawkes, Holly Walsh, Alan Davies and Lucy Porter. The chairman's script was written by Dan Gaster and Colin Swash and the producer was John Naismith. It was a random production for BBC Radio 4.